Early March in 1906, in a temple in the southwestern city of Jai, it is said that an ominous warning appeared on a tray of sand, such as which are used by trance mediums to write marks dictated to them by deities. The message in this case was the Chinese phrase, Shui Huo Zheng Ju. A direct translation would be, fire and water quarrels. But metaphorically, its meaning is some great clash between opposing forces. This would be remembered as a warning sign of impending disaster when a week later, on March 17th, Jai was hit by a massive earthquake, the Meishan earthquake of 1906.
The Taiwan History Podcast, Formosa Files, is made possible through the generous sponsorship of the Frank C. Chen Foundation. Formosa Files.
We're going to visit Taiwan in the year 1906 in the company of French war correspondent Reginald Kahn. Drawing on his never-before-heard travel account, at least never-before-heard in English, of Formosa in that year of 1906.
Reginald was a Frenchman of about 40 years of age and already a veteran war journalist. He'd covered various wars around the world, including the Boer War in South Africa, and on the Boer side, and the Russo-Japanese War, and he was covering that from the Japanese side.
So we'll be using his account, not really long enough to call a book.
Right. So his report on Formosa, Japan's first colony, was first published in French and later in Dutch.
But never published in English.
Correct. But with the translation power of AI and my very knowledgeable friend, Mark Swofford, yes, he made an English version for us and tidied it up.
Okay, so our Frenchman Reginald Kahn came to Formosa on a small Japanese steamship serving the Danshui route from Amoy, now called Xiamen. So this is spring, early spring 1906. The Japanese have been masters of Formosa, well, most of this island, for 11 years. Reginald's steamship crosses the turbulent waters of the Taiwan Strait and arrives near the mouth of the Danshui River.
Here it needs to anchor, waiting for the moment when the tide will allow the ship to cross a sandbar where there is only 13 feet of water at high tide.
Whoa, just 13 feet at high tide. So like two of me plus a foot.
Amazing. Yeah. The passengers had several hours of tedious waiting, during which the rough seas tossed them about, and then they could finally enter the river. The passengers took a train to the capital, Taihoku, Taipei, right? A distance of only 20 kilometers, and it took about an hour.
But following the advice of a Japanese fellow traveler, our journalist decided to stop halfway at what he called the winter resort of Hokkaido, now it's Beitou, known for its rich sulfur springs.
The government had set up a military hospital and public baths there, and he was assured that it was the only European-style hotel on Formosa.
But the so-called hotel turned out to be a single room furnished with only a bed, and, quote, the owner was a dirty and always drunk Chinese man, end quote. So he left that uninviting place the very next day to find a less pretentious Japanese inn in Taihoku, Taipei, which he says was quite good.
Always drunk owner. That's a bit harsh and hasty. Our guest was only there, less than 24 hours.
You would defend him, wouldn't you, John? Anyway, this new place would be his main residence during the 2 months he would spend on the island.
So he's in Taihoku, the capital city, and a strong first impression was the complete separation between the Taiwanese and the Japanese. He says the Japanese, quote, inhabit the center of the city, the actual Taihoku, from which they have pushed the residents back to the populous suburbs of Banka and Daodaochang.
He says the Japanese part is very similar to Tokyo, with sealed, well-maintained streets, telegraph poles, and low wooden houses topped with gray tiles. In contrast, non-Japanese areas had narrow, dirty streets and a bustling, dirty crowd of people dressed in rags.
But our journalist companion is not blaming the local people. he points out that this separation of Japanese and Chinese was not done with the consent of the local population. No, quote, "The authorities had to resort to arbitrary measures. They seized Chinese-owned shops under the pretext of hygiene concerns, without providing any compensation. This disregard for the natives can be found everywhere on the island in various aspects of governance."
Okay, so it's important to remember that at this time, the colonial rule in Taiwan was military rule, 100% military, not civilian, under the absolute power of the governor general, and this governor general was chosen from the military, no civilians involved in governing.
Military feel to the place, too. I mean, Japan had only just finished, was still subduing the island after years of fighting.
Reginald's initial plan was to stay in Taihoku, or Taipei, for a few days, to study the political and administrative structure, and visit some wilder areas inhabited by indigenous people.
However, a terrible earthquake had just devastated Jai in the southwest of the island. This is the Meishan earthquake of March 17th, 1906, magnitude 7.1. So he decided to go there immediately.
So he can go by train? In November of 1900, the Takao-Tainan line in the south was open for traffic. That's a 45-kilometer long line, so we're talking about Kaohsiung to Tainan. Construction progressed on the other areas, but there were financing difficulties.
Yeah, Japan was fighting a war with Russia, the Russo-Japan War of 1904-1905, and it was expensive. But afterwards, work resumed, and in 1908, the main line from Taipei to Kaohsiung was completed. So when this French journalist visited, it was 1906, not yet completely finished.
Right. There was a section in the central area of about 40 kilometers where they had to use these narrow gauge push cars.
Our visitor was not a fan of the early railway line. He said it was exasperatingly slow. It took him more than a day to get to Jai.
More than a day. I'd have to say this guy's a little bit ungrateful because go back just a decade earlier, it would have taken a week or two of overland travel or a faster but much more dangerous trip by sea.
Indeed, yeah. He complained he had to spend a night in an inn, a small hotel, and then the following morning his train arrived at the end of the normal line where the passengers had to transfer to a narrower gauge line, those push rail cars you mentioned.
Yeah, the push rail cars. So we're talking about those wheeled trolleys equipped with a primitive brake. They're pushed by two men each, or occasionally women. And Reginald, he writes, quote, "At a trot, these men push the trolley a few meters and then jump onto it, remaining there until it comes to a stop on its own, after which they repeat the process. Going downhill, these things could move at an astonishing speed," and he writes, "it's a pleasant feeling, despite the real danger, which manifests itself in numerous derailments, often accompanied by accidents resulting in broken limbs and even deaths."
Ooh. On upward slopes, passengers frequently had to get off and climb uphill on foot. Reginald says that after 2 hours of traveling in a push cart, at a speed that was no less than that of the train, they had to switch back to the train carriages, which brought them to Jai on that second day.
So like all cities in Formosa, in Jai, the Japanese lived in a separate district where the hotel was also located. Reginald says he was fortunate to encounter Professor Takagi there once again, the director of the colony's health service, whom he had met in Taihoku or Taipei. This official, who studied in Germany for an extended period, was married to a European woman. He'd come to Jai to investigate the relief efforts and to see how the local authorities had set up the hospitals where the earthquake victims were accommodated. Professor Takagi helped arrange for the Frenchman to visit these hospitals.
Well, that's a very good name to have when you're in Jai, because the old name for Jai was Kagi.
Correct.
Okay, since most of the government buildings had been destroyed or were at risk of collapsing, various types of shelters had been set up. The military depots provided some large tents, but most infirmaries consisted of bamboo sheds covered with rice straw. Reginal says it reminded him of field hospitals he had seen 2 years ago in Manchuria covering the Russo-Japan War.
Yeah, but he's not critical. He says the physical facilities of these hospitals and the care provided to the patients seem excellent. The nursing was carried out by hospital sisters and Red Cross brothers. These would be both Japanese and local Taiwanese. Although the Red Cross organization had only recently been established in Formosa, it already had 23,000 members. And Japanese surgeons from all over the island had been sent to Jai. They were joined by many students from the medical school for Taiwanese people in Taipei, established 4 years ago by the same Professor Takagi, and under his supervision. Takagi was very curious about how his students had fared, and he was pleased to see they successfully performed many difficult surgeries, including amputations.
Wow. I don't think there would have been that much anesthetic going around. Ooh.
No.
These Taiwanese medical staff did a great job. It wasn't the language barrier the Japanese doctors and nurses had. They could comfort patients, they could ease their fears, because the locals were very superstitious and fearful regarding modern medicine. People were reluctant to have surgery or some to take off their clothes for treatment.
Right, okay, because a lot of Western surgeries or even taking off your clothes, that's not part of traditional medicine.
Right.
The Japanese district, right? So remember, there's a Japanese district in every city, and then there's the local district. The Japanese district where the hospitals were located had relatively little damage from the disaster. This was, Reginald was told, because all the houses were constructed of wood, the tile roofs were quite lightweight, and the entire buildings were designed to withstand a strong quake. And that's the case in Japan today. He says, quote, "I was able to confirm that this same day, when a strong tremor was felt in the evening, causing the hotel guests to flee to the garden, it caused no damage at all."
As for the Taiwanese part of the city, it was, quote, "nothing more than a heap of ruins. Only very few houses have withstood the devastation, and the inhabitants of those have not yet had the courage to return. The entire population is bivouacking in the open air, or has sought shelter in hastily erected sheds, similar to the hospitals."
And Reginald says the total number of victims in the Jai district alone exceeded 2,000.
Not sure exactly what he means by victims, but the accepted numbers today are deaths, 1,258, more than 2,000 injuries, almost 7,000 houses destroyed.
So Reginald Kahn, our French war correspondent, says that although the city of Jai itself had suffered a lot, the tremors there were much less severe than in several surrounding villages, some of which were completely wiped out. These places were, quote, "close to a place located halfway between the city and the sea. Particularly remarkable natural phenomena are said to have occurred, and I am advised to visit it."
That doesn't make sense to me. This has him heading westward towards where I live. But Meishan, after which the earthquake is named, that small town is to the east in the foothills.
Yeah, we will find out in a second what this natural phenomena was. But the local authorities arranged for a sedan chair and four bearers to carry him the next day, which was the only available means of transport. And he says, quote, "the most commonly used mode of transport in Formosa, where animals are scarce and most of the time no vehicles can be used because there are few roads, and the inhabitants usually walk along the narrow embankments that enclose the rivers." So he's saying, you know, the only thing you can do really is get in one of these sedan chairs.
Yeah, sedan chair. Listeners' first thoughts are probably about how guilty they would feel being carried by fellow humans. And yeah, I have that reaction. Of course, I'm rather heavy, so yeah.
But no, I know what you mean, though. It seems, however, that it wasn't quite as luxurious as you might imagine, because he writes, quote, "my sedan chair was kind of a square box, very low in height, in which one couldn't sit or lie down. Instead, one had to assume a squatting posture. As soon as the journey began, there was the jolting motion caused by the coolies while they walked, making the discomfort even greater. Something I couldn't endure for long. I decided quickly to abandon the uncomfortable conveyance and travel on foot to cover the 20 kilometers that separated us from our destination. I was on this excursion in the company of a Japanese police officer. John, maybe he was just too big to fit in the box. He was a white woman and too big.
Yeah, and we're not that good at squatting, are we?
No, we are not. That's right.
All right. So anyway, it's a lovely time for a walk. It's March, a nice month. He's passing through rice fields and sugarcane plantations. He says the villagers each had a solidly built house, which stood out from the other houses. It had the appearance of a miniature fortress, a high fence, barbed wire on top, and a deep ditch. These buildings were residences for Japanese police officers.
He goes on to describe how the administrative regulations grant police officers almost unlimited power over the residents in areas where they're stationed. During his stay in Formosa, he says, "I observed their authority is often exercised very arbitrarily and sometimes with rough cruelty."
Some of these Japanese, he says, were recruited from the old class of military samurai, who have always shown disdain for the other classes, especially the farmers, even in Japan.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty natural that if they disdain their own farmers, they would have even greater contempt for Taiwanese people.
He says, quote, "Draconian laws have been enacted against those who attack the police, and this had to be done in regions where the officers were stationed in remote areas to ensure their safety. Anyone who attacks an officer is sentenced to death, and complicity is punished as severely as the crime itself."
But personally, he has no complaints about the police. He says, quote, "They are extremely hospitable to foreigners. It was impossible for me to pass one of their posts without resting, smoking a cigarette, and drinking the traditional cup of green tea."
He's slowed down by all this tea drinking, but around midday, he arrives at the scene of this natural phenomenon, and it's something of an anti-climax.
Yes. So he writes, "The famous rift that was supposed to have formed turned out to be nothing more than a trench a few centimeters deep, which I wouldn't have noticed if they hadn't pushed aside the grass that grew on both sides to show it to me."
Oh, he's definitely in the wrong place. He's gone in the wrong direction from Jai City. I've heard the fault was visible and, much bigger than that.
Yes, but there were still signs of seismic action in that area. He says, quote, "The springs and wells from before the shock had all dried up, and small geysers of boiling water had formed in other places. One of them had lifted the floor of a house, filling the space with sand and steam. A little further, they pointed out trees whose trunks had split in two, and the two parts were now separated by a gap of several centimeters."
After a final night in Jai, during which he was repeatedly disturbed by alarming rumors of renewed earthquakes, he returned directly to the capital of Tohoku. Now, another foreigner also visited Jai in the quake's aftermath. It was the Scottish Presbyterian missionary William Campbell, who came up from his headquarters in Tainan to see what was happening. Campbell praised the quick, professional, and dedicated Japanese medical and relief response.
So this missionary Campbell also describes, quote, "a profound feeling of sadness on seeing whole streets covered with fallen beams and other debris. Many of the narrow escapes and calamities were very affecting, particularly that of our blind evangelist, whose name was Taon, who ran out of the doors with his wife as the shaking began. The mother, however, could not bear the thought of her two helpless young children being left behind, and she darted in to rescue them, and my poor blind pupil became childless and a widower in an instant of time."
People ran out of their houses when the main quake hit, which was at 6:43 in the morning, but some returned to their damaged houses later to collect valuables and were killed by the aftershocks.
And as always happens in the case of every natural disaster, there are stories, of close escapes. There was one Japanese mother reportedly kind of saved by her kid. The infant cried out for, changing its diaper. The mother was carrying it out to the toilet, I guess an outhouse. The earthquake struck and the house collapsed, but they survived.
And one Taiwanese man was said to have been saved by the tiger god. deity that's usually worshipped as the mount, the transport or a servant protector of other gods. So this man was trying to save the statue from the temple during the earthquake when a large beam in the temple collapsed on him, and he was only slightly injured, but the statue was totally shattered and six other people in the temple were killed.
So what do you think, John, were the long-term effects of this 1906 earthquake on both Jai and all of Taiwan?
Well, it destroyed some local industry. Many small local sugar factories were destroyed or suffered financial losses, which gave an opening for big Japanese investors and companies to move in. But there was a boost to the construction industry, of course. Part of the rebuilding was using timber to the east up in the mountains, right? This gave a boost to the Alishan forestry. We see a railway line built, that forestry railway, opened 6 years after the quake. Part of the reconstruction was for temples, and related to that, we see a boost to China sculpture, China as in porcelain, figurines and sculptures for temples, a special kind called Cochin China. Jai became a center for this this kind of ceramic.
Interesting. And Reginald Kahn writes about the fatalities, quote, "As is often the case in Chinese countries, women are among the dead in larger numbers. Their poorly developed feet prevented them from evacuating their homes quickly enough."
Fatalities for the earthquake were 551 men and 700 women.
Okay, John, your math is better than me. What would that be percentage-wise? What's the difference?
Well, I calculated it beforehand.
Okay.
Okay, 12% more women. And for injuries, there was a 20% difference. Again, more women.
Okay, that doesn't seem like a huge difference, but apparently a different situation from earthquakes in Japan. And this difference raised public concern because foot binding in Taiwan was greatly discouraged at this point, 1906, but not yet banned. The earthquake increased pressure on ending the horrific practice of foot binding.
Yes. Another change brought about by the earthquake was a greater acceptance of modern medicine and also of the Japanese authorities. It seems the police, the often hated police, had performed well in the relief. Their search and rescue work, distributing supplies, generally helping people. And what made an especially deep impression was their handling dead bodies. The Taiwanese thought touching corpses would bring bad luck. So here you had the police endangering themselves for the people.
That's a very interesting little cultural insight. I see from Wikipedia that Jai was hit by another huge earthquake in 1941.
Yes, the 1941 Zhongpu earthquake, magnitude 7.2 on December 17th. Zhongpu is a district of Jai to the southeast of the city. There were 358 deaths, making it the fourth deadliest earthquake of the 20th century in Taiwan.
Okay, yeah, but the worst would be the 1935 Shinchiku Taichu earthquake, a 7.1 magnitude, its epicenter in modern-day Taichung. It claimed 3,276 lives. The second deadliest was the 1999 earthquake, you know, Jo-er-e 921. We talked about it in the last episode. And the third is this 1906 Meishan earthquake.
Eric, did you notice the date of that fourth deadliest quake, the 1941 Zhongpu earthquake?
Yes, I did. December 17th, 1941. So just 10 days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which brought the Americans into World War II and, you know, sealed the fate of Japan.
10 days after Pearl Harbor. So not surprising that there were numerous rumors that the earthquake had been caused by the United States bombing the island in retaliation.
Interesting. Well, as of this recording, it's just been a few days since the April 3rd, 2024 earthquake that hit Hualien. A serious and large earthquake, but thankfully, it resulted in fewer deaths than might have been expected. It's been shocking how quickly they've recovered, however. Bridges that were out have been somehow figured out within like 2 days. So, you know, we are Taiwan. We rally, we rebuild, and we learn lessons from earthquakes so that the next one isn't as deadly.
Preach it, brother. Yes, very heartening resilience and professionalism seen in the aftermath of this earthquake. And also assistance from our international friends. Yeah, it makes you proud to live in Taiwan, doesn't it?
And on that note, we're going to have to say goodbye. Thank you for listening to Formosa Files. I'm Eric Michael Smith.
I'm John Ross. Bye.